Municipal Research, a private fact-finding organization located in an office building at 261 Broadway, which was about to become a virtual arm of the city government. Robert Moses' education was over. He was beginning the career in public service about which he so often had talked with so passionate an idealism. The quadrangles of Oxford were behind him. Instead of cloisters, there would be the arena. And one day in the summer of 1913, dressed in his clean white suit, Robert Moses carried his bright, shining idealism down to 261 Broadway and flung it on the table to find out what it was worth in the game of life. Part 2. The Reformer. Chapter 4. Burning. It must have seemed like a great time to be young and a reformer in New York. In all American history, in fact, it would have been hard to find a better time. The young idealist entered public service in the very year in which there came to crest a movement, progressivism, that was based, to an extent greater perhaps than any other nationally successful American political movement, on an idealistic belief in man's capacity to better himself through the democratic process. An outgrowth of the agrarian populist crusade of the 1880s and 1890s, the progressive movement had been swelled before the turn of the century by the enrollment of America's urban middle class, its conscience awakened by Lincoln Steffens, Jacob Riis, and other muckrakers who dramatized the poverty of the slums, and by the testimony of its own eyes, which could see all too well, in the horrors of child labor in the sweatshop, the problems that flowed from the new industrial order. In searching for the causes of these problems, progressives settled on the most easily identifiable, the giant corporations and corrupt political bosses who they felt had stolen mythical America away from its people. To exorcise these demons, to force a return to the political democracy and economic individualism that Americans were fond of believing had once existed in their country, they advocated reforms equally simplistic, so simplistic, in fact, that they proved primarily that the old American impulse to do good was still intact. And they were reforms that a young man who wanted to do good, a young man like Bob Moses, could advocate with all his heart. One of the major demands of progressivism was one that he himself had called for in his PhD thesis, removal of the spoils system from the federal civil service. And if, in the thesis, he had discussed the need for great new departments of government to combat the excesses of industrialism, more and more, the reformers were coming to demand intervention by government, the only St. George hefty enough to slay dragons of the size being bred in America. In 1913, the cheers for Wilson's New Freedom Reform Program were ringing from virtually every corner of the country except the bastions of privilege. In the state houses, it was the era of Altgeld of Illinois, of Pingree of Michigan, of Charles Evans Hughes, exposer of corruption in New York's large insurance companies, and of Robert Marion La Follette, who broke the power of the railroads in Wisconsin and sponsored laws limiting working hours for women and children. It was the very height of an era of optimism and hope for America. As the time was right for Bob Moses, so, seemingly, was the place. If there was an epicenter of the idealism that was rolling across America, it was the ninth floor of 261 Broadway. The impulse to do good may have been rampant beneath the domes of state houses and the national capital, but it reached its zenith in city halls. Perhaps this was because in cities corruption was more visible than in federal politics, issues more succinctly dramatized. Or perhaps it was because the reforming impulse thrived on problems, and it was in the cities, swelling with the immigrant tide, faced with problems of housing, schooling, policing, fire protection, traffic regulation, and sewage disposal on a new scale, that America's problems were beginning to loom largest. Unlike European cities, which also mushroomed in the industrial age, but which had been built atop previous centuries' strong administrative foundations, America's had sprung into gianthood relatively overnight, often organized around nothing but the factory or the mill, and had no such tested governmental framework. What framework they did have was undermined by blatant corruption, their governments controlled by private interests and by political bosses who, with their Christmas baskets and everything the basket symbolized, marshaled hundreds of thousands of ignorant voters into vast, seemingly impregnable political machines. With very few exceptions, asserted historian Andrew D. White, the city governments of the United States are the worst in Christendom, the most expensive, the most inefficient, and the most corrupt. To combat these conditions, reform movements sprang up in almost every large city in the United States, and in no city was progressivism more vigorous than in New York. In New York, its spearhead was the Bureau of Municipal Research. To many observers, in fact, the Bureau was the spearhead of municipal reform not only in New York, but throughout the United States. Historian Charles A. Beard was later to conclude that its methods constituted nothing short of a revolution in the approach to such matters. The three young men who had founded the Bureau in 1907, William H. Allen, Henry Bruere, and Frederick A. Cleveland, believed, as did the city's older reformers who had backed them financially, that the growth of forces which had diminished the individual's control over his own destiny had made it incumbent on government to ride to his rescue with increased welfare services. But this trio, known among reformers as the ABC, added to the reform ethos new elements derived from two other passions of the era, natural science and scientific management. The emphasis of natural science on empiricism, on first-hand observation, on the obtaining of facts, led them to conclude that it was vain to talk about changing the philosophy of government before learning the facts of government, and they said, therefore, that the first step toward reform should be analysis of government operations. From scientific management, the age was marveling at the assembly line techniques introduced by Henry Ford, they concluded that after government operations had been analyzed, the next step should be not a change in philosophy, but an improvement in such operations to make them efficient and economic, to ensure that the city would get far more for each dollar spent than in the past, and would therefore be financially more able to do what the voters desired. Their philosophy, seemingly so elementary, was new in 1907. Previously, in New York and in all American cities, reform crusades had been of the throw-the-rascals-out variety, stung to fury by particularly blatant corruption, good government elements would rise up, oust the reigning political bosses, and seat in the mayor's chair a hero who they hoped would save the city. But salvation was invariably denied because the administrative systems of cities were so chaotic that change in the direction of government was all but impossible. Budget, for example, was only a dictionary word. In turn-of-the-century America, not a single city possessed one. Allocating money with reference to the total amount available and to the relative urgency of the needs of the various city departments was therefore impossible. Scientific accounting techniques, only recently incorporated into American business, had never been adapted to government, so departmental requests for appropriations were not itemized, and therefore items could not be compared with comparable expenditures in the past. In New York, for example, the Board of Estimate made appropriations without even checking to see if there was, or would be, sufficient money available in the city's treasury to cover them. If money ran out, the board simply issued revenue bonds to make up the difference. Departmental requests to the board were lump sum requests, which showed in only the most general way how the departments proposed to spend the money they were asking for. Unable to analyze these requests, the board simply cut each by the same predetermined percentage, a procedure which some departments circumvented by requesting five times as much money as they really needed. Given such administrative chaos, the careers of the reform heroes were predictable. In city after city, they failed to make an appreciable dent in municipal problems, and after a term or two, the rascals they had thrown out were back in. In New York, where the businessmen reformers of the Citizens Union had thrust Columbia University President Seth Lowe into the mayoralty in 1902, Tammany had taken back City Hall in 1904. Said Bruere, "There was the constant futile search for the great administrator, great by instinct and personality. He wasn't found because he doesn't exist. A great administrator needs the tools and techniques of sound administration. The search, he said, should not be so much for good men as for these good tools and techniques. The idea should be not so much to jail the grafters as to install in government business systems which will make grafting difficult. Before government could become humanitarian, he said, it must become businesslike. The city's businessmen listened to the ABC and put up the money so they could go to work. Confident that if the citizenry only knew the facts about government, it would take the right steps, the three young men decided first to determine and disseminate such facts. Momentarily stymied by the refusal of notoriously corrupt Manhattan Borough President John F. Ahern to show them his records, they began to check records that could not be hidden, the construction contract specifications that borough presidents were required by law to publish in newspapers, to see if the specifications were being followed. Construction workers began to notice the presence of young men in high collars, vests, and bowler hats who spent whole days performing such inexplicable maneuvers as counting bags of cement. When the count was finished, the young men had discovered and proved that the city had, in collusion with favored contractors, paid for hundreds of thousands of dollars of supplies such as bags of cement, that had never been delivered. The Bureau of Municipal Research published its first report, How Manhattan is Governed. In the time-honored ploy of politicians whose party is in power, Ahern demanded an official investigation, assuming that it would be conducted by Tammany faithful. Unknown to him, however, Mayor George B. McClellan, Jr. had just decided to break with Tammany. McClellan gave Ahern the investigation he had asked for, but the man appointed to conduct it was an independent 28-year-old Yale graduate and lawyer, John Peroy Mitchell. Mitchell confirmed the Bureau's findings. City Club President George McCainany, ignoring Tammany pressures on his business, volunteered to deliver Mitchell's report personally to Governor Hughes with his own endorsement, and Hughes summoned Ahern to public hearings in Albany. At the hearings, Ahern said he didn't know anything about the contracts. Hughes said he should have, and removed him from office. As the businessmen reformers hastily established a fund to make the Bureau a permanent institution, the ABC started counting bags of cement in the Bronx and Queens, a mathematical exercise which would result in the removal from office of the presidents of both those boroughs. The offices of the Bureau were filled with excitement. The ABC, young themselves, gathered around them a group of recent university graduates determined to reform municipal government. They had a sense of mission. One, writing a history of the Bureau, said there was in it not a little romance. Said another, the men in training were looking for adventure, and most of them found it. The young men developed techniques that were to reform every aspect of municipal government and create a new literature on the science of public administration. They devised the first budget used by any municipal governmental unit, a primitive model employed by the New York City Health Department in 1908. They invented line-by-line itemization to eliminate lump-sum budget requests and organization charts similar to those coming into use in business to make responsibility easier for voters to pinpoint. When enthusiastic press support forced the Board of Estimate to adopt the Bureau's innovations, city departments, for the first time, had to show what they had spent money for in the past year and which items they wanted increases for. And, for the first time, citizens could understand and could judge a department's record. Tammany Hall called it the Bureau of Municipal Besmirch. But its exposés led to the election in 1909 of anti-Tammany reformer William J. Gaynor as mayor. And when reformers McCainany and William A. Prendergast were elected to borough presidencies, they reorganized their offices along lines the Bureau suggested. In 1911, the Bureau founded its training school for public service, the first educational institution in the United States dedicated solely to preparing young men for work in government. The young idealists of the era of optimism saw in it a chance to obtain training in a field in which their idealism could most easily be translated into effective action. By 1913, there were hundreds of applicants for its handful of places. Bob Moses was one applicant for whom a place was waiting. Since his mother was a cousin of one of the Bureau's trustees, Columbia Professor Edwin R.A. Seligman, and a friend of several others. When he finished his thesis, he was allowed to enroll immediately, was told to share one of the tables that served as desks with a student named Meter, and was taken on the tour of City Hall that was the student's introduction to municipal government. In theory, even his own theory, Moses should have been happy at the Bureau. With its concentration on the improvement of the mechanics of government, it was, after all, addressing itself to concerns that he had expressed in his thesis. The admission policy of the training school, moreover, answered the main demand of the thesis, the need for university men in public service. Only applicants of the most impeccable scholastic background were accepted. Moses understood this. In his thesis, he had written that the Bureau and its training school were the system of the future in American cities. But once he became part of the training school, it didn't take Moses long to decide that the system of the future wasn't going to be his future. In the field of public administration, the training school was unique in its down-to-earth practicality. Pupils not only were put through intensive reading courses on the theory of budget making, accountancy, scientific management, chart making, and the use of forms, summaries, and statements, but also spent long days in city offices watching budgets actually being made up, and did their scientific management homework sitting in city offices trying to figure out ways to eliminate unnecessary personnel and analyzing projects the city was undertaking to see if they were really needed. They did the legwork for the Bureau members who were heading the investigations which would result in exposure of corruption or waste in city government. The students were filled with an esprit so strong that it seemed sometimes as if it must surely waft out the windows of 261 Broadway and melt some of the soot from the blackened granite of the Tweed Courthouse below. They believed in the importance of what they were doing. A half century later, roomy eyes would light up and smiles would curl corners of wrinkled lips as they talked about it, and they talked in terms old soldiers reserve for old battles. "How would I sum up what we were doing?" one would say. "We were fighting to make democracy work. That's what we were doing." They were very proud of their position in the army of idealism. They idolized their leaders. Allen, Bruere, and Cleveland, they knew, were the very men who had charged through a hail of public abuse and private threats to pull down three Tammany chieftains. Who knew what victories over corruption might not be won through the use of the information they were collecting in their daily reconnaissance through the files of City Hall? Watching John Peroy Mitchell stride by their tables to confer with his friend Bruere, they whispered to one another that they hoped the young lawyer would decide to accept the fusion nomination for mayor. The ninth floor bubbled with excitement. "You couldn't walk in there without getting an assignment," recalls one training school student. "You'd open the door and someone would yell, 'Hey, glad to see you. Get up a memorandum on this.' And you'd go back out the door and over to City Hall without even taking your hat off." For a while, Moses seemed at home in this atmosphere. He did the legwork, wrote the memos, joined the other training school students for 20-cent lunches at Child's, and for their one big splurge of the week, a six-course Sunday dinner at Luchow's, which might cost as much as $1.25. He didn't interrupt, as they didn't interrupt, when one of the older Bureau staffers was telling again the story of how everybody in the Bureau had jumped to his feet and cheered on the day that a reporter brought the news that Governor Hughes had just announced that the charges against Ahern merited a public hearing. At first, he was very popular with the other students. He was pleasant and friendly, and had a gift for putting people at ease. Many of the students admired Moses. Those from Midwestern universities were new to New York and slightly awed by the big city. Moses obviously knew his way around. Moreover, most of them were struggling along on students' allowances, and they knew he came from a wealthy family. They were thinking about what they were going to do after graduation from training school, and they knew Moses would be able to choose his job without regard for financial considerations. In the late afternoons, when they were all heading for the subway for the ride home, they watched him grab a taxicab. Occasionally, they might be talking about an opera they had seen the night before, having been lucky enough to secure standing room tickets, and they would ask Moses if he had seen it. "Oh, yes," he would say. His family had a box. But the young idealists admired Moses most for his education. It wasn't just that he had been to Yale. The world's principal centers of education for public service were Oxford and the University of Berlin, and Moses had studied at both. Now he was attending the most advanced school for public administration in the United States. One of his friends wondered, quite seriously, whether Bob Moses was not the man best educated in public administration in the whole country. Within a few months, however, the students began to notice another quality in Moses, a quality which became more apparent almost day by day. Blazing behind the big gray eyes, they now saw, was a furious impatience. Within months after entering the training school, Moses made clear that he felt he had learned all it had to offer. He was irritated by the report cards, by the weekly conferences with his bureau advisors, by all the aspects of school life that made him remember that it was a school and that he was still, at the age of 25, a student. In particular, he resented the legwork. The training school men were required to summarize the results of their investigations in memos that had to be written as if they were official bureau reports, but that would actually be seen only by the bureau men who were writing the real reports that would be published. Moses wanted his memos published. He began to press for admission to the bureau itself, making clear that, because he had an allowance from his mother, he would require no salary. Within a year, on that financial basis, he was admitted. His student days were over. The impatience was not slaked. No sooner was he in the bureau than he began to make cutting comments about its procedures. The voluminous filing and cross-filing of all information was a waste of time, he said. The weekly staff luncheons were a waste of time. The bureau's constant emphasis on procedure was a waste of time. The bureau wasn't getting enough done, he said. But it was becoming apparent to many of his colleagues that the bureau would never be able to get enough done to satisfy Moses, no matter how many technicalities it dispensed with, simply because the bureau was merely an agency that investigated and advised government. The way to get things done, Moses was making clear, was to be in government. Through Bella, he had a nodding acquaintance with several members of Mayor Gaynor's administration. He began to neglect his work at the bureau and spend more and more time at City Hall hanging around their offices. His colleagues began to whisper about Bob Moses. The slang of the era contained a phrase that described what they thought he was doing. He was, they whispered, pushing his acquaintance at City Hall. There was an adjective heard frequently in the whispers, too. The adjective was ambitious. Bob Moses, the idealists of the bureau said, was interested, much too interested, in making a name for himself. But if there was ambition, that was only a part of what was driving Bob Moses, and the whisperers never saw the other part, for they never saw what Moses did in the late afternoons after he grabbed the taxicabs. Sometimes, of course, Moses would tell the cab driver to take him straight home, but often he would ask to be dropped off across the west side on Riverside Drive at the end of 76th Street near the Hudson River. And as he climbed out of the cab there, he climbed out into a scene far different from the doormanned serenity of Central Park West. He would be standing on the high bluff that was Riverside Drive. Behind him, if he looked up, stately apartment houses would appear to be swaying over him against a backdrop of moving clouds. But he would be looking down. Below him, along the edge of the river, was a wasteland 6 miles long, stretching from where he stood all the way north to 181st Street. The wasteland was named Riverside Park, but the park was nothing but a vast, low-lying mass of dirt and mud. Running through its length was the four-track bed of the New York Central, which lay in a right-of-way that had been turned over to the railroad by the city half a century before. Unpainted, rusting, jagged wire fences along the tracks barred the city from its waterfront. In the whole 6 miles, there were exactly 3 bridges on which the tracks could be crossed, and they led only to private boating clubs. The engines that pulled trains along the tracks burned coal or oil. From their smokestacks, a dense black smog rose toward the apartment houses, coating windowsills with grit. The smog had an acrid odor, but people who lived in the apartments hardly noticed it. It was scarcely worth mentioning, alongside the stench that seemed to hang over Riverside Drive endlessly after each passage of a train carrying south to the slaughterhouses in downtown Manhattan, carload after carload of cattle and pigs. When, despite the smell, Riverside Drive residents were driven by the heat to open their windows, they were kept awake at night by the clank of the couplings which hooked the cars together. Walking in the park was adventure. The walker sank at intervals into the landfill of which it had been constructed, for water had eaten away much of the fill from below. In many spots, it had broken through the crust of the fill to form little lakes. Every year, the park grew smaller as its edge crumbled into the river. Areas that were still solid had been appropriated by the railroad for wood-lined pits in which coal was piled. Lying along the river were heaps of rotting timbers, stored years before by some city department and forgotten. At 79th and 96th Streets, untreated garbage mounded toward the sky. The sanitation department used those areas as dumping grounds from which the garbage was transferred to scows which towed it out to the open sea. But somehow, the rate of transfer was never fast enough to clear the refuse away entirely. Other solid spots held human refuse. Derelicts, who had built tar paper shanty towns considered so dangerous that the police stayed away from them. At night, the open fires over which the derelicts cooked flickered in the darkness below the drive. Looking south, Moses could see the bluff sink and the park narrow until both disappeared, and houses, factories, and warehouses crowded close to the waterfront. The railroad tracks wended their way between the buildings, making several sharp curves, and then emerged on 11th Avenue, along which, at street level, trains inched their way in a straight line down to the foot of the island. In front of every train, to warn away pedestrians and drivers, rode a cowboy on a horse, waving a large red flag. Since the trains came at frequent intervals and moved extremely slowly along the avenue, traffic was frequently backed up for blocks. Often, a driver would become impatient and ignore the warning flag. For that reason, 11th had become known as Death Avenue. For years, the city had tried without success to find a solution to the problem posed by the presence of the railroad along the west side. In the late afternoons, as the sun sank toward the Palisades across the Hudson, Bob Moses walked along Riverside Drive. He walked down the steep paths to the park, over one of the bridges across the tracks, and, skirting the dirty tar-paper shacks, along the edge of the clean blue river. And as he walked, he dreamed. One Sunday in 1914, he was crossing the Hudson by ferry to picnic in New Jersey. With him were some college friends and their dates, one of whom was Francis Perkins, later to be United States Secretary of Labor. As the ferry pulled out into the river, Moses leaned on the rail, watching Manhattan spread out behind the boat. Miss Perkins happened to be standing beside him, and suddenly she heard Moses exclaim, "Isn't this a temptation to you? Couldn't this waterfront be the most beautiful thing in the world?" As the woman looked at him in astonishment, words began to pour out of Bob Moses, and she realized that he had it all figured out. How you could build a great highway that went uptown along the water. How you'd have to tear down a few buildings at 72nd Street and bring the highway around a curve. He wanted places where people could leave their boats safely, public clubs, like private clubs. Staring back at the bleak mud flats covered by a haze of smoke from the railroad engines, she heard Moses paint for her a picture of what the scene could be like on a Sunday. the ugly tracks completely hidden by the great highway, cars traveling slowly along it, their occupants enjoying the view, and along the highway stretching green parks filled with strollers, tennis players, and families on bicycles. There would be sailboats on the river and motor yachts tied up in gracefully curving basins. And the thing that astonished her most, Miss Perkins was to recall, was that Bob Moses had the exact location of tennis courts and boat basins quite definitely in mind. The young bureau staffer beside her was talking about a public improvement on a scale almost without precedent in turn-of-the-century urban America, an improvement that would solve a problem that had baffled successive city administrations for years, and he had it all figured out. Moses was to talk again to Miss Perkins. Every time he did, her astonishment grew. He was always burning up with ideas, just burning up with them, she was to say. Everything he saw walking around the city made him think of some way that it could be better. Happening once to comment that it was too bad that mothers who took infants to Central Park had to leave when diapers needed changing and go all the way home, she saw her idle words strike instant fire in Moses' mind. Why not build diaper-changing shelters? He asked. They could be small structures, used for no other purpose. You wouldn't even need attendants. The cost would be small. Or perhaps they could be additions to comfort stations already built. The cost would be smaller yet. It should certainly be looked into. Moreover, not all the ideas that he told her about required concrete and steel. Bob Moses, she realized, had thought through detailed new concepts of city budget-making and social welfare legislation, prison administration and school administration, filing systems, and methods of conducting public hearings. But while Francis Perkins was impressed by Moses' imagination, the Bureau was more impressed by his impatience. Challenged at staff meetings about some details of those of his ideas that he had presented, he responded as Bella did at Madison House board meetings, making it clear that he wasn't much interested in long discussions. The ideas were good. What was needed now was to put them into practice. Impatience became frustration. Moses wanted the Bureau to take up his ideas officially at once and press the city to adopt them. The Bureau had other projects on which it was already working and which it considered equally important. When it got to Moses' projects, they would have to be thoroughly studied. And as to those suggestions about public works projects like the highway, well, the ABC was not at all certain that the Bureau had the expertise or the responsibility to start suggesting public works. The frustration boiled over. Moses became more and more critical of some of the Bureau's own procedures, which he felt were keeping it from accomplishing as much as it could. This criticism, offered with conspicuous lack of tact by one of the newest members of the Bureau, rubbed senior staffers the wrong way. They felt the procedures had brought the Bureau success. They were particularly incensed at several of Moses' suggestions aimed at speeding up the preliminary work that went into reports. While Bruer felt that some of these suggestions were worth looking into, Cleveland and Allen were more precise, careful men who believed in checking every possible aspect of a situation before writing anything about it, and most of the staffers agreed with this philosophy. The reaction to rebuff was not graceful. Moses' irritation with the Bureau began to spill over into his work. He didn't feel it was important anymore. Investigations didn't accomplish anything. He didn't want to count barrels of concrete. He wanted to pour them. He had said the weekly staff luncheons were a waste of time. The Bureau, believing they were valuable for interchange of ideas, declined to eliminate them, so Moses simply stopped attending. With increasing frequency, sent over to City Hall to get material for a report, he would return without the material and say he had met one of the city officials he knew, and we had a very interesting conversation. Acting as advisor to several training school students, Moses developed the habit of writing large question marks in the margins of their reports next to statements he questioned, and the papers often were returned with their margins literally filled with these indications of his displeasure. Sometimes the papers were not returned at all. "I have your memorandum, and it's no damn good," he would say to a student. I threw it in the wastebasket. And the student would find out that Moses meant exactly that. The memo had actually been thrown away. The student would never see it again. He used his tongue as a lash on his advisees. One, considered a brilliant prospect, and in fact later to become one of the country's leading experts on police administration, emerged from a conference with Moses so depressed that he gave up his hopes of a public career and resigned from the bureau. It was only with difficulty that he was persuaded to return. Breuer, who knew Bella and Emmanuel Moses socially, stayed tolerant toward their son, but Cleveland and Allen made it clear they were not prepared to put up with his behavior much longer. Moses, they said, just couldn't seem to learn to work as part of a team. Bureau gossip said he would be fired shortly. Only one person at the bureau was sympathetic. She was a woman who worked as Cleveland's secretary. Mary Louise Sims was slim, of less than medium height, and rather plain, but gay and vivacious. With ash-blonde hair and a clear white skin, she looked fresh and clean. She came from Dodgeville, Wisconsin, one of the six children of a Cornishman who worked in the little town's lead and zinc mines. Mary's family didn't consider itself poor, but, as one of her sisters put it, there wasn't much money to throw around. When Mary decided that she wanted to go to college, she had to earn her first year's tuition as a 17-year-old teacher in Dodgeville's one-room Little Red Schoolhouse, and then, after she entered the University of Wisconsin, work her way through. After she graduated and began to work full-time in Madison, the state capital, a portion of her earnings each week was still put aside for college tuition, for a younger sister. In Madison, Mary was a secretary, but that was not an adequate description of the work she did. Her employer was Francis E. McGovern, the governor of Wisconsin, and McGovern noticed that Mary had an instinct for and insight into politics, including the merciless infighting that was part of the decor in any state house. He used her as confidant and advisor. But Mary's ambitions were not for herself. She had sought out a job with a politician not because she was interested in politics, but because she was interested in what politics could do. She was another of the moths who in the years before World War I hovered so thickly around the flame of idealism. In 1913, Cleveland and Allen visited Madison to study Wisconsin's governmental structure. No one could explain it better than Miss Sims, the governor said, and delegated her to show the visitors around. She had already become interested in the efficiency and economy movement. In the course of the tour, Cleveland and Allen talked to her about how they were trying to make democracy work, about fighting to free government to institute reforms that would really help people. Mary resigned as the governor's secretary and came to New York to work for the bureau. In 1914, she was 30, 4.5 years older than Bob Moses, and was known to bureau staffers and students for her friendliness, her quick wit, and the depth of her belief in what they were doing. Bob Moses fell in love with her. Although women had always been attracted to him, Moses had never before, although he was 25 years old, centered attention on any particular one. But now he talked about Mary constantly, and he talked about her in terms that left no doubt that the pedestal he had placed her on was a high one. The lover of the good, the true, and the beautiful seemed to feel that he had found their embodiment. He was, a friend said, very, very much in love. His devotion was complete. Taking Mary along on his walks around the city, he poured out to her his ideas and his frustration at the indifference with which they were received by the bureau. At the bureau, they would meet in the library, among the books, and they would sit and talk for hours. He introduced her to his friends. They noticed that she was always gay and laughing, but that she could also, in a quiet way, deliver a remark that could demolish an opponent's argument, or an opponent. The bureau's whisperers soon learned that it was unwise to let Mary hear their criticisms of Moses. If she did, she would not hesitate to let them know where, despite her feelings for the bureau, her first loyalties now lay. They just didn't understand Bob, she would say. One day, he would get a chance to show what he could do. And as it turned out, the chance came soon. Having finally accepted the fusion nomination, John Peroy Mitchell had been elected mayor on November 4, 1913, at the age of 34. Bruere had become his closest confidant, the expert who provided the tinder to fuel Mitchell's zeal. Bruere provided the facts and theories, Allen was to say, and Mitchell took fire with them. Now, as mayor, Mitchell made Bruere city chamberlain, and he asked the Bureau to list the city departments most in need of reorganization and to recommend Bureau experts equipped to advise on the reorganization. Near the top of the Bureau's list was the Municipal Civil Service Commission, and Allen, Bruere, and Cleveland found that only one staffer in the Bureau was an expert on civil service. They had no choice but to submit his name to Mitchell, and when, in 1914, the mayor appointed a new civil service commission, he asked the commissioners to rely for technical assistance on this man, and to regard him as if he were in fact on the city payroll. The new commissioners found the man a more than willing assistant. At last, he was being given a chance to participate in the actual workings of government itself, in workings that could change men's lives, in workings that could make a city a better place to live. Into the work of the Municipal Civil Service Commission, Bob Moses hurled all his energy and all his brilliance, all his zeal for reform, all the long pent-up enthusiasm and fire of the boundless idealism of his youth. Chapter 5. Age of Optimism. In setting out to reform New York City's civil service, Bob Moses was setting out to break into the plunderhouse of politics. The wheels of the Tammany war machine might be greased with money, but the machine was pulled by men, the men who voted Democratic themselves, the men who rounded up newly arrived immigrants and brought them in to be registered Democratic, the men who, during election campaigns, rang doorbells and distributed literature to those immigrants and to their own friends and neighbors, and on election day shepherded them to the polls to vote Democratic. And the most succulent of the carrots that lured these men forward, that kept their shoulders braced against the ropes that pulled the Tammany machine, was the carrot of jobs. Jobs for themselves, jobs for their wives, jobs for their sons. The only source of jobs on the scale required was the city itself. So the jobs Tammany had to control in order to control the city were the city's jobs. Positions as policemen, firemen, sanitation workers, court clerks, process servers, building inspectors, secretaries, clerks. There were, in 1914, 50,000 city employees, and this meant 50,000 men and women who owed their paychecks, and whose families owed the food and shelter those paychecks bought, not to merit, but to the ward boss. Patronage was the coinage of power in New York City, and reforms of the civil service, such as Moses was to propose, were therefore daggers thrust at the heart of Tammany Hall. Tammany understood this well, and Tammany knew how to defend itself. It always had. Reformers might have forced the adoption of civil service merit systems in one city after another, but in New York, though Tammany might have been forced to make token reforms in other areas of government, civil service was the line at which reform stopped. In New York, in 1914, merit was still votes deliverable. The ability that determined who got the jobs and which job holders got promotions and raises was still number of relatives, relatives of voting age, or rightness of connections. Under such a system, civil service was chaos. Offices were filled with so many clerks and secretaries that supervisors couldn't possibly provide work for all of them. One secretary might be receiving $25 a week. The secretary at the desk next to hers, doing identical work, might be receiving $47 a week. Some city typists were getting $1,200 a year. Others were getting $4,000. When giving tests of the ring-the-gong variety to candidates for jobs requiring physical strength, lifeguard or fireman, for example, the examiner painted over the candidate's side of the dial which registered the force with which the gong was struck, so that only the examiner could see the results, and the results the examiner reported frequently had a relationship less to strength than to amount. the amount of money the candidate pressed into his hand. More than 1,200 employees had been exempted from any competitive examination at all. No aspect of city mismanagement was more frustrating to reformers than civil service maladministration. What good were campaigns to change the government if the people running it, administering its machinery, were still the same unqualified, inefficient, indifferent political hacks? John Peroy Mitchell's announcement that he intended to clean up the civil service, therefore, was especially cheering to reformers. The impeccability of the reform credentials of the two men he selected to form the majority on the three-member Municipal Civil Service Commission, new chairman Henry Moskowitz, a meek, disheveled social worker who had been the first head worker of Bella and Emmanuel Moses Madison House, and banker Darwin R. James, a natty one-time Princeton track captain and president of the Brooklyn Bureau of Charities, cemented their optimism. Samuel H. Ordway, chairman of the Civil Service Reform Association, said, "We expect great things, a real advance in civil service administration." But generations of Tammany civil service commissioners, masters in their own way of the art of government, had been there first. Anxious to blaze a path straight to the door of rectitude, Moskowitz and James found themselves trapped instead in a maze of technicalities constructed over decades primarily to keep great things from happening. Civil service administration, the two reformers soon realized, was an art and a science. And it was an art and a science they knew absolutely nothing about. Not trusting longtime Commission Secretary Frank A. Spencer, or Spencer's assistants, to lead them out of the maze, Moskowitz and James tried to fire them, learned to their frustration that one of the technicalities prevented this, and settled for transferring them to other departments. And they turned to the young man from the Municipal Research Bureau as their guide. From a technical standpoint, they made a good choice. Two men who had read Moses' thesis, it had been published, were Luther C. Steward, first president of the National Federation of Federal Employees, and H. Elliot Kaplan, later president of the New York Civil Service Commission and executive director of the Civil Service Reform Association. Years later, when Kaplan had read everything there was to read on civil service, he was asked to evaluate the thesis and said simply, "It was a masterpiece." There were, he said, very few people in the United States in 1914 who knew much about civil service. Bob Moses really knew. Stewart's wife, who had been working beside her husband in 1914, was even more emphatic. Bob Moses wasn't one of the men in this country who understood civil service best at that stage, she said. He was the man who understood it best. James and Moskowitz asked Moses for a plan of action. Moses said that the first step had to be a reform of the city's efficiency rating system, the system of ratings given by supervisors to their subordinates to help determine whether to promote a civil service employee or give him a pay raise. Under the present method, ratings didn't give the Civil Service Commission enough information for a sound judgment. Making an evaluation system precise was perhaps the most difficult job in civil service, Moses explained. Each job had to be broken down into component parts, so that each part could be graded, and in totaling the grades, each part had to be given a mathematical weight corresponding to its importance in the job as a whole. But he knew how to do it, he said. Impressed, James and Moskowitz told him to go ahead, and let it be known that they were considering bringing the bureau staffer into city employ and starting him off at the top, as Spencer's replacement as commission secretary. Then, one morning, Bob Moses found his name in a newspaper. "Only gentlemen need apply," a headline said. "That is Moses' theory of civil service requirements." "Because he is being considered as a likely successor to Frank Spencer," said the article under the headline, "Moses' Ph.D. thesis, of which he acknowledges the authorship, and in which he openly advocates that positions in the government service should be open only to university men and gentlemen who had inherited breeding and culture, has caused a mild sensation in civil service circles." It was a small article, five paragraphs in the Brooklyn Eagle, and no other paper bothered to pick it up. but it must have served as a warning to the Mitchell administration of the line of attack that would be used if Moses was appointed, and of Moses' peculiar vulnerability because of the thesis of which he acknowledges the authorship to such an attack. There was no more talk of the appointment. The article marked the first appearance of Moses' name in a New York newspaper. It was his first direct acquaintance with a newspaper leak. To the average reader, it would seem that a reporter had discovered the thesis himself, or had been motivated to look for it because of the mild sensation he had noticed in civil service circles. But there had been no sensation, mild or otherwise, over Moses' rumored appointment. Hardly anyone in city government even knew who he was. Actually, Tammany had simply done a little research and tipped off a reporter to the existence of the thesis and had told him what he would find if he went up to the public library and looked at it. The story could be taken as a first of another type, too, a first hint of what was to come, a gentle intimation that politics, in its own way, was rougher than water polo, that the race Bob Moses was entering was not a swimming relay, in which judges watched the touch-offs to ensure that everything was fair. It could be taken as a reminder of how important patronage was to Tammany, far too important to let anyone take it away. Disposing of a young man's hopes for a minor city appointment was so simple it was hardly worth mentioning. A little newspaper leak, done offhand by some politician who had more important things on his mind, could take care of that. Were the threat to grow more serious, however, there were other methods. If it was a hint, however, Moses didn't take it. He would have liked Spencer's job, but the job wasn't what was important to him. Reforming the civil service was. He set out to do it. The Bureau assigned 10 men to Moses as assistants. The idea of working under him didn't appeal to the older men, but the younger ones, who hadn't known him before, liked him. "He worked all of us hard," one of them recalls, "but he worked himself harder. He was at the Bureau when you got in the morning, and he was still there when you left at night. He'd lose his temper, but it was silly to argue with him anyway, because you knew darn well that he had looked the point up before he talked to you and knew it better than you did." Moses' assistants sat for days watching city workers perform their jobs so that they could break each job down into gradable components. They observed employees of private businesses. They interviewed department heads and civil service commissioners in other cities. Soon, memos addressed to Dr. Moses were flooding onto his desk. By the spring of 1915, he was able to begin writing the detailed report on the rating of the efficiency of civil service employees, excepting members of the uniformed forces in the police and fire services, and in the lower ranks of the street cleaning service. Day after day, he sat in the Bureau, his fine-pointed pen racing over the pages of yellow legal notepads. Often, coming across a point he wanted to check himself, he would fling himself out of his chair and out of the Bureau offices, and stride, sometimes breaking in his haste into a few steps of a run, and then self-consciously checking himself and settling back into a walk, over to City Hall or the Municipal Building, where he could see records and officials himself. Soon, to save time, he asked for and was given a desk of his own in the Municipal Service Commission offices on the 14th floor of the Municipal Building, his first toehold in the halls of power. He wrote and rewrote sections of the report before sending them off to the typist, and when they returned, the fine-pointed pen slashed at the neat pages, crossing out words, putting in others, clarifying, refining, hardening. On July 8, 1915, after 19 months of work, he typed on a Bureau letterhead, "Dear Commissioner James, I am transmitting herewith detailed report." Under the present system, Moses reported, most department heads simply gave each of their hundreds of employees C, or average, ratings on their report cards, rather than try to pinpoint outstanding or delinquent workers. To obtain more accurate ratings, he wrote, department heads must be required to give each employee arithmetical grades in dozens of categories. In addition, there must be a complete reclassification of the civil service, adding many new levels to ensure that employees would be given the precise salary and authority they deserved. There must be a complete standardization of salaries so that employees doing the same type of work would be getting the same pay, even if they were working in different departments. The commission should have authority to see that promotions and raises were given strictly on the bases established under the system. Moses' proposal was a codification of idealism. Omitted, at the insistence of Moskowitz and James, was any mention of higher division, lower division, or university men. There was to be only one standard for promotion in public life: open competition, how hard and well a man worked and how he performed on examinations. Examination results would be posted in public, and report cards would be open to public inspection, so that every city employee would know the basis whereon he and his competitors were judged. Seniority would become unimportant. Not experience, but ability would be crucial. The proposal was of a purity, a strength, and a scope that was almost more religious than governmental. The system was to be completely new, Moses said. All traces of the old must be washed away, and it must be all-embracing. All government service, he said, could be divided into 16 categories: executive, legislative, judicial, professional, sub-professional, educational, investigational, inspectional, clerical, custodial, street cleaning, fire, police, institutional, skilled trades, and labor. Each category could be divided into specific jobs. Custodial, for example, into caretakers, janitors, watchmen, storekeepers, and bridge tenders. Each job could be scientifically analyzed to show its functions and responsibilities. Each function and responsibility, and there were dozens of them for most jobs, could be given a precise mathematical weight corresponding to its importance in the overall job. And the success of the employee in each function and responsibility could be given a precise mathematical grade. These grades would, added together according to weight and combined in service records for each employee, furnish conclusions expressed in arithmetical terms, and these conclusions, and these alone, should be used as a basis for salary increase and promotion. It was the proposal of a fanatic. John Calvin, specifying permissible arrangements for women's hair in 16th century Geneva, was not more thorough than was Bob Moses enumerating the functions and responsibilities of New York's civil servants. No aspect of conduct on the job was too small to be graded. Even personality must be reduced to number. Personality, Moses said, includes those intangible elements the existence of which do not readily admit of proof, but nevertheless, each employee must be rated on personality. Men would have to make sacrifices for the sake of the system. Acknowledging that some present employees would not score high enough on his tests for the jobs they held, he had a simple solution. Such employees would have to accept demotions and pay cuts. Unnecessary employees, he said, would have to be eliminated. The idealism was harsh and uncompromising. In judging the ability of an examining officer, said one of Moses' aides, echoing Moses' views, a pretty fair clue is the number of below-standard ratings given. The more below-standard ratings, the better the examining officer. If there could be such a thing as a Calvinistic civil service efficiency rating system, Moses had devised it. Moses did not deny there was a human element involved. He knew of its existence all too well. It was constantly interfering with the mathematical perfection of his system, and it must be suppressed. It is essential, he said, to have a definite, almost a mechanical, program of adjustments in order to avoid personal and political pressure. For some reason, it was hard to make examiners understand this. They were always becoming sympathetic to individuals and talking about the human factor, and an examiner who always wishes to take the human factor into consideration is a dangerous man to associate with such work. The consideration of the human factor is entirely a matter of policy for policy-determining bodies in applying salary and grade specifications. The infusion of people, moreover, was always interfering with the work to be done. Annoyed that his recommendations had to be discussed at public hearings, he noted that because of the time he had to spend at such hearings, it is difficult to keep the field work running smoothly and correspondence up to date. There must, he said, be some limit to public discussion. Shining through all Moses' statements